Hi, this is Mickey Huff, the director of Project Censored. The Project Censored show is supported by you, the listener, through our Patreon page. We couldn't make this podcast without your support, and if you haven't already, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Project Censored. There are some awesome perks for being an official Project Censored show patron, and your support will go towards future projects, such as our upcoming Project Censored independent news video series. Thanks for your support.
We want to smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, best pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want. We want a liberated land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll hear more from the historic interview featuring Peter Dale Scott and Daniel Ellsberg, two of America's leading public intellectuals. In this segment, the two authors debate what forces drove U.S. interventions in Asia in the 1960s, especially the Vietnam War. They also explore contemporary topics, including whether today's U.S. politicians have completely erased the diplomatic progress of the 1980s. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Recently on the program, we presented the first hour of a conversation between Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg and prolific political writer Peter Dale Scott. Although these two scholars have been friends for years, they had never been interviewed together. But last October, Temple University doctoral student Aaron Good recorded Ellsberg and Scott in conversation at our Project Censored Media Freedom Summit at the College of Marin. On this week's Project Censored Show, we present a second excerpt from that historic conversation. In the first part of this week's excerpt, Ellsberg and Scott address the role scientists might play in public decisions. They look back to World War II, when the U.S. pushed ahead with the effort to build an atomic bomb, although Allied intelligence had reported that Germany was not close to building such a weapon. Later, after Germany had surrendered, the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. More than 60 of the scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project had signed a petition asking that the bomb not be used without first demanding that Japan surrender. But the military dropped the bombs with no prior ultimatum, and the scientists' petition had been sidetracked before it could reach President Truman. After the war, most of those who signed the petition lost their jobs. Another document drafted by physicists, known as the Frank Report, also urged nuclear restraint, but it too was disregarded by General Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project. In the following excerpt, we learn about the activities of the scientists Eugene Rabinowitch, Leo Szilard, and Joseph Rotblat. Here now, Daniel Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott.
I think there will always be this problem of how does intellect contain brutal power politics. It's the brutes who want to govern. You wouldn't want to run for president. Nobody at this table would run for president. But power attracts a certain kind of person. And the best thing I can say about the American Constitution, we used to, in the past, sometimes think it was a bad thing about it, that it so limits the power of presidents to get things done. It's often very frustrating. But the dangers of unlimited power were having acted out for us in the headlines every day under Trump. If Trump could do what he wanted, he might have launched a nuclear weapon before now. The man can absolutely not be counted on to be reasonable about anything. You see him in these rallies encouraging to beat up the protesters who were there. It's a very devastatingly bad influence on American politics. The country's divided as it hasn't been for decades. But he's limited. And we, I think, have to beef up the limitations on power. And I think that means that the scientists the ones who didn't quit when Rotblat did, they should have given more thought how to stop this from going straight to General Groves and Truman and let them make the big decisions, because they'll make the wrong decisions.
Well, look, they did. There was this group, I'm saying, that did think about it. So there was the Franck Committee in Chicago, because their main work had been done now at the metallurgical lab, and the work of assembling the bomb was going on at Los Alamos. So the people of Chicago could now sit back and do something, by the way, that Franck had asked as a demand for his participation in the whole project. He had been involved in the Like Haber in the German chemical warfare problem in World War I. And Haber, Fritz Haber, who more or less invented chemical warfare, his wife committed suicide, generally understood to be because of her feeling of guilt and horror at the gas program. But Franck, who was later a Nobel Prize winner, said, all right, if I'm going to be involved in a government program like this, I want to be assured that I will have the chance before it's used to weigh in as a scientist on what the possibilities are and what the problems are. And so he had this committee, which recommended as follows, and just to boil it down to one thing. What they foresaw was not only thousands of atom bombs in a race, but they saw the H-bomb from the beginning. They had since 42. Mm-hmm. So this has the power to destroy civilization in it. Thousands of H-bombs, eventually hydrogen bombs. And by the way, we're talking to an audience here now where I won't go into it now, but where I've discovered dozens of times over, hardly any American knows the difference between an A-bomb and an H-bomb. Well, I won't, yes, absolutely, but I won't go into that right now. The point being, they will get much larger and they'll have the possibility to destroy civilization. There is no possibility of avoiding a disastrous arms race if we go ahead with this weapon without the Russians' participation, our allies, mm-hmm. in the war, we're taking most of the casualties by far, 10 times factor, in the war. If we do this secretly, in effect, hostily, without them as an ally, there will be an arms race, and there will be no stopping it. There will be no possibility for international control of this. If we even test the weapon without their presence, but certainly if we use it in Japan, and therefore They had a petition, actually, of scientists, which was, as you say, stopped by Groves from ever getting to the president, which in its first form said, don't do this even if it would save American lives. Mm. Truman never saw that. It was signed by, at the first instance, by about 60 scientists, eventually more than 120, a little softer. Consider, you know, not doing it. Consider moral situations. It didn't say flatly, don't do it. But even that was never seen by Truman. Now, one of the members, the rapporteur of the group, Eugene Rabinowitz, who later became the head of the Federation of American Scientists and of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, with its doomsday clock, which just moved forward to 2 minutes till midnight, the first time since, I think, 1954, when the H-bomb was first tested. So he said, Rabinowitz said, they should leak this. They shouldn't go through channels. They should get it to the press. And he later said, when I and my wife were underground evading the FBI in 1971, putting out the Pentagon Papers, during that period, he wrote a letter to the New York Times saying, with respect to the Daniel Ellsberg case, I wasn't reading this at the time because we weren't seeing the New York Times, moving from one apartment to another while I put out more copies of the Pentagon Papers, the different papers. So what I didn't see then, or for many years later, was he said, I, in the spring of 1945, spent sleepless nights deciding whether I should or should not release the information of what we were planning to do, namely release this bomb on Japan. And as he put it later, he said, I have no illusion but that the American public might well have endorsed this, might have gone along with it, but at least they would have shared the responsibility. They would have known what was about to happen. And of course, the main thing he wanted to put forward to them, not simply that this was going to kill a lot of people, we were already doing that with our firebombing in Japan. We were killing more, as many as we could. More. And the bomb simply was a more efficient way of doing that, not a larger scale. Actually, the killing in Tokyo on the night of March 9th and 10th, 45, killed about 100,000 people, or much more than either Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
People jumped into the canals and were boiled
to death as the canals were boiling. So 100,000 people were burned to death. Not a better way to die, actually, than died at Hiroshima, which was also still mainly from fire. All right. He said, at least before we do it, the real danger of that is not that we replace firebombing with atom bombs, but that we will go into an arms race, which in all of civilization will. So he said, I still believe, he said in 71, while I'm underground, I still believe that I would not have been wrong had I done so. Well, let's put it a different way. He would have been right. That was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
No one did it. Szilard apparently didn't consider doing that. Well, he'd heard Rabinowitz, but he didn't consider doing that. But the FBI feared that he might, and so they put him under tremendous watch at that point, Szilard, to see if he might leak it. But no one did. And no one ever since, basically, did this. None of the scientists who thought that building the H-bomb, which was 1,000 times more powerful than the A-bomb, the fission bomb, the H-bomb required a Nagasaki-type bomb as its trigger. And most of our weapons have always since then been H-bombs. They required Nagasaki bombs to detonate them. When Truman left office in 52, we had about 1,000 A-bombs, fission bombs, targeted on Russian cities and East European cities. 1,000. When Eisenhower left office, we had 23,000 weapons, mostly thermonuclear, many of them 1,000 times more powerful, 20 megatons, million tons, than Nagasaki, which was 20,000 tons equivalent of TNT, and that was 1,000 times the largest blockbuster of World War II, 20 tons. So it was from 20 tons to 20,000 tons to 20 million tons, or a factor of a million since World War II. And we had, as I say, 23,000 such weapons. Under Kennedy and Johnson, the figure got up to, I think, 36,000 weapons, of which, as Herb York put it, when he asked at Livermore, his old laboratory, he was the first director, physicist, how many weapons does it take to deter someone rational enough to be deterred at all from initiating a nuclear attack? How many cities have to be at risk? And he suggested one, or perhaps 10 weapons to be sure that you got one or two or three. And he said, to go at another point of view, how much the largest amount of destruction you want one man to be able to inflict? He said, supposing just arbitrarily we take World War II, 60 million people as the most we would want a Trump or a Khrushchev or a Gorbachev or whoever to be able to inflict, or a Hillary Clinton, 60 million. He said, well, that would be about 100 H-bombs, 100 kiloton weapons. So he said something between 1 to 10 to 100 would seem to be adequate for deterrence, and closer to 1 than 100. Well, we had, as I said, in 67, we had about 32,000. And the Russians came to have about 40,000 eventually. We're way down now, 85% reduction. We have only 4,000 operational weapons, 1,500 on alert, 1,550. The Russians about the same. But what it takes to cause nuclear winter in the way of cities burning, to create the smoke that will starve nearly everyone, is a couple hundred, or somewhat less than what China or France or England, they all have about that amount, 10 times less than we do. They all are on the verge of being able to do that if they targeted all their weapons on system. We can do it 10 times over. And both Russia and the U.S., for a variety of reasons, keeping power, making a lot of money for the people who support your campaigns and your congressional campaigns and your media and your advertisements and everything else, and jobs. Every one of these weapons now, when Boeing makes a weapon, it subcontracts in 48 to 50 states, generally. So every senator has people in their state who said, our jobs depend. They do that deliberately. So what we have, as E.P. Thompson, the Marxist historian, put it, this was in the Soviet Union at a time where, for a Marxist to say there was any symmetry between the U.S. and capitalist U.S. and Russia was total heresy. He said, it's misleading to say that the U.S. and the Soviet Union have military-industrial complexes. From his point of view, it's more correct to say They are military-industrial complexes. And if we put in the industry, the DOD budget, but also intelligence and surveillance and all of that, it's not the majority of our GNP or anything else, but it is the cutting edge of R&D. It's the use of scientists and engineers of development. And that's true in both countries, which are both capitalist right now. The question is, how do we – here is the operative political question for it now. How can we mobilize or induce enough people, enough numbers of people, and enough commitment to counteract or to challenge and possibly overweigh the political influence of Boeing and Lockheed? And, you know, Rotblat was – like a whistleblower, with one exception, when he left the Manhattan Project. He was threatened with being deported or even prosecuted if he told his colleagues at Los Alamos why he was leaving, namely that there was no German program and that it was immoral and wrong and unnecessary and unjustified to continue in that light, and that we should be now thinking about how do we keep this genie in the bottle and not let it out? He was forbidden to tell that, and he didn't, because he didn't want to be deported. So he wasn't allowed to be a whistleblower. People, their mouths have been kept shut by various coercive means all this time, and very effectively.
I think the control of information is a much bigger force in this society than most Americans are aware of.
Yeah.
And I would like to, and I don't think there's enough attention being paid to, first of all, the scope of the problem, and secondly, what on earth are we going to do?
This is the Project Censored Joe. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're listening to part of a historic conversation between Peter Dale Scott and Daniel Ellsberg, arranged by doctoral student Aaron Good and recorded last October at the Media Freedom Summit for Project Censored. Daniel Ellsberg became a household word in 1971 when he turned over the secret Vietnam War documents to the press, documents that became known as the Pentagon Papers. He was charged with espionage and faced a possible life sentence, but the court dismissed the charges against him, owing to gross prosecutorial misconduct. In our interview, Ellsberg explains to Scott why he leaked the Pentagon paper.
I think empire is definitely older than capitalism, and in fact pretty much coexistent with civilization as we know it, with agriculture after the last ice age, with cities, going back to Sumer, about 2000 BC. Very similar. The histories there are very recognizable. And in fact, one reason I wanted to get the Pentagon Papers out, even though, as my wife at one point asked me, after all, Fulbright has backed off from this, and other senators, they don't seem to think it's important enough to get this history out. Why do you think it is? For me, it meant going to prison for life, and not for them, and they didn't think it was worth it for them. And I said, because I see this as one of the very few documented histories we have of an imperial operation here. It's very clear in the Pentagon Papers that we did not regard the government of Vietnam as a sovereign country that we had to deal with. We saw it as something we could change as we could, you know, if we wanted from one day to the next, pick out some, bribe them, kill them, whatever. It was our thing. And it strikes me as I say that our thing is a translation of Cosa Nostra, you know, what the mafia talk about themselves. But they're talking about their coalition, if I'm not mistaken, you know, people around the table, the various families, our thing. And we didn't think of the GVN as sitting at the same table with us by any means. They worked for us, or they served at our sufferance. So I said we have an imperial operation here. And I think since the Nazi archives were found in East Prussia, if I'm not mistaken, in Prussia, in East Germany, we haven't had documentation of an imperial project like this. And my suspicion is that the Pentagon Papers of Greece, Rome, Assyria, or Sumer would read very much the same, but we don't have them, basically. And so this is really something to learn from. I don't think, by the way, it served that purpose very much. You know, people haven't read them or studied them from that point of view or learned. Why didn't we learn from the Nazi archives? Well, those were the Nazis. Those were Germans. You know, we had no more to learn from them than we had to learn from the French, the racist imperial French. They were different. They were different species, in effect. So that told us nothing about ourselves. Well, the Pentagon Papers suggested that there was something very like ourselves there in what we'd seen earlier. And let me ask this question, Peter, which I thought of today when we were going to talk. You brought home to me the point of how important the role of the dollar as reserve currency, was mm-hmm. to the American empire, sealed in particular by Saudi demand that oil be paid for in dollars.
Well, it was something we persuaded the Saudis to accept.
Yeah, exactly.
And they imposed that on OPEC. And then every now and then a country would decide not to take, you're selling to Europe, let's take euros. That's what Gaddafi did in Libya. Look what happened to him. That's what the Iranians were threatening to do. I don't know where the status is of that now. That's what Assad, not the present one, but the father, wanted to do in Syria. This is a very dangerous thing for a third world country to think of, which was accepting money for oil in anything but dollars.
Okay, now,
so that's absolutely crucial to the petrodollar.
That could be changed by any large market here deciding to do it differently, as you say, Iran and the others, to accept euros or accept some other currency. Everyone knows, I mean, we hear this all the time, that China could destroy us essentially by calling
China and Russia are planning seriously to shift the reserve currency away from...
Now, question to you, which I don't have any clue on. What do you see happening in the world should that happen? Supposing we were brought down, China would suffer too as a world depression economic or losing us as a market to some extent. But supposing for whatever reason they did bring us down.
There are constructive and destructive ways this can go. As you just said, I mean, there's so much Chinese-American trade now that despite the tariffs that Trump is putting on, it's going to continue to be one of the basic facts of the global economy. And if America goes down, China will go down. The hope is that this web of economic interaction will create an interest in some, whatever the changes are, and there will be changes. The dollar is not going to continue the way it is forever. That there will be constructive changes. The destructive idea, which is more or less what happened in the 30s, as everybody for themselves, and, well, you see what happened there is World War II.
Well, what is a way, a constructive way, that the dollar could be dethroned here, no longer reserve currency, and something good come out of it? What would that be?
Again, I think dethroned is too strong a metaphor. What you want is some kind of orderly transition into a more rational global sharing of the reserve currency notion. And that can be done, could be done in theory, by all of the great financial powers working together. What I think is more likely to happen in practice, because it is happening, is that Russia and China, very slowly but very methodically and very carefully and astutely, are creating the basis for a different reserve currency. And then the question would be, what will the relationship of the dollar be to that currency? And again, it's something that could be negotiated or it could just be bringing down, as you say, dethroning the dollar. And I think the second smells of the 30s, and I hope that doesn't happen. But then for orderly progress towards global order, it seems to be up to now there's only been one way to get that, and that's to fight a world war and exhaust the military powers of everybody so they start fresh. I hope that isn't going to be the way it's done this time.
You're describing World War II as a kind of resolution of a worldwide problem. I don't usually think of it in those terms.
Well,
exactly.
I think it moved us towards a more rational global order. I mean, that's the silver lining on a horribly dark cloud.
Mm. Well, one country becoming overwhelmingly dominant for a while.
Well, afterwards. That's something else. That didn't have to be. The real notion of the UN, if people had lived by it, America would not be the superpower it is. There would have been, the superpower would have been the Security Council. But because of Korea and other things, it didn't work out that way. Initially, the UN was America's tool to limit Soviet power. But then as more and more countries joined the UN, it more or less turned around to the opposite, to be a way in which the Third World was exercising power on America. So America now just ignores the UN. We barely think of the UN when we go and fight a war in another country. To me, that is a symptom of the breakdown of the American global system that was, it was essentially American, that was imposed after World War II. It's not working now at all, and we need to replace it. And we also, if we can, need to replace it without fighting another war to get a new order.
My general point is actually not that we are worse than other people. I don't think we are as a country or as an empire. I think we're not better than other empires.
Archivist.
And what that means for the future is empires are now competing in a world in which, in their competition, first of all, in the nuclear weapons, they can destroy everyone. And on the other hand, they are dominated. When we say deep state, we're including in that Exxon and the other former Seven Sisters and so forth,
right.
Chevron and the others. There are important corporations, very powerful corporations in this country, who have an interest in maintaining a doomsday machine, a capability of destroying life on Earth, not because they want to do that, but because preserving the capability is profitable to them. Making the threat is actually very convenient to our statesmen in their alliances, protecting them. It's a protection racket, essentially. So there's these two things. It's very profitable to make and sustain a doomsday machine in the short run and in the mid run. And that's why they do it, and that's why they're doing it in Russia, too, I suggest, for very much the same reasons, and in other countries. I think in practically every country that has a nuclear capability, a major aspect of that, I've been told, and I find very plausible, is that it's a black budget. It's not in the regular budget in all respects, which means that the opportunities for bribery and for slush funds and for corruption are almost unlimited. And I think that's why Pakistan has as many nuclear weapons as it has and is getting more, that there are many people who make a profit from producing those weapons. And so do they need 120 weapons? Well, that would be a trigger to killing billions of people by the effect on smoke. Exactly what does that do for Pakistan? But it does very well by some people who are making those weapons.
Well, you have to change the morality. The business schools, including the one at my university, they teach that responsibility of a CEO is to maximize profits for and dividends. As long as you're thinking that way, what you say is true. But if they were to think a little bit like human beings, they say in order for there still to be an Exxon two centuries from now, we have to think on a higher level. Somehow you've got to get people to move. The problem, if we can get somebody in the White House who recognizes a lot of people, you know, are doing lip service to the idea that there is a climate crisis, that crisis thinking should produce high-level global thinking on how to produce solutions. And I think actually, you know, baby steps have been taken. Not big enough steps, but the process is there, and the process needs to be restored. And the Trump interruption needs to be regarded as a hiccup, not the permanent turning away from this process. I think we have to go back to that process, and will.
And will, because we have to.
Yes.
Because the alternative is disaster.
Because I'm an optimist, and you're a pessimist, right?
I don't think that the need to do this to survive is sufficient reason that it will happen. In other words, I think that disaster is not only possible,
but likely.
I don't think it's inevitable because I don't know enough about anything in social, human. I don't think anyone does to be justified in certainty as to how things will go. There have been good miracles, we've discussed this, that didn't bring heaven on earth by any means, but the downing of the Berlin Wall, the end of the USSR and so forth, the tyranny in that country was totally unforeseeable. Even if people had thought about the possibility, they would have said impossible, and it happened. No, likewise, Mandela becoming head of South Africa without a violent revolution, impossible, but it did happen. So these things can happen, and that's what I'm working for without knowing what right. will help, but I want to help participate in another miracle of that sort. I don't think it's guaranteed at all.
No, but I agree with you even that there's a serious risk of nuclear disaster. And you say the world, in a sense, is moving towards that way. The clock is closer to midnight. But the opposite is also true. And I think that you can choose to look at the dark side and you'll see the forces working. You can choose to look at the bright side. And I do think that we're not in a fatally predetermined historical situation. We're in an open situation where it depends on how much energy is devoted, including from people like us. You know, everybody has a stake in helping to make the final determination whether the world will come out of the present crises facing it or whether it will just succumb in failure to another world war.
Peter, we certainly agree, and we always have, that the world is not fatally determined in any respect. Although I would carry that one step further, it is not inevitable that we will rise to this occasion, this challenge, you know, et cetera.
No.
I would go further and say it's unlikely. We're going against the odds on this one, but that doesn't make it any less urgent or necessary to keep trying.
I come from a much smaller country, Canada, and, you know, I learned as an undergraduate, if you hear a minister say something wrong, you can get a question asked in Parliament, which I did as a sophomore, and something is done. And so I think one of the reasons that I'm so much surer than you, Dan, that these problems could be addressed is because I come from a smaller country where it's easier to address problems. In America, the country is so huge that I think in the popular imagination it's sort of identified with destiny. It's the way things are. No, it's a country, and it's a country that can be changed. And, of course, it is much, much harder with a country that is so powerful. The big problem is that the changes are going to have to come from the great powers, and the great powers, by definition, are the ones where it's hardest of all for an individual to make any effective change. But you have to keep in mind that it is possible, and you and I are saying the same thing here. Whether you're going to achieve anything or not, you've got to try. I've been trying for 40 years to change this country. It's gone systematically in the opposite direction. But you still have to try.
We're not disagreeing on the question of whether it is impossible to change.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't think it was possible, I wouldn't be doing anything
you're
I do.
You're a man of hope. Exactly.
What? Obviously.
Yeah.
And same as you, very much. You mentioned in your book, I was just reading, that you think it is helpful and even necessary to become aware of the gap between how we describe ourselves, what we tell, or what our leaders tell us we're doing,
mm-hmm.
and the reality of what we and they are doing.
Right.
We have to
yeah.
change that gap. And I'm not sure it is necessary. In the end, we'll make the change. If there is a change, will it be because people became aware of the history? Maybe yes, maybe no. But it is the case that you and I are working on that aspect of the problem.
That, yes.
We're acting as if we hope that might help make a change.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're listening to a conversation between Daniel Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott, recorded last October. In this segment, they revisit the 1965 coup and massacre in Indonesia, an event whose death toll may have been in the millions, but is rarely spoken of in the United States. In this next segment, Scott and Ellsberg debate the possible motives of the Johnson administration officials who supported the massacre. Did they see it as fighting communism or as aid for Western mining interests eager to expand operations in Indonesia?
What does it mean to be human? It can be human to go out and grab and exploit, or it can mean to enjoy using your life to the highest end that you can imagine.
I say both. Both of those are human.
Right.
And you do say, I was just seeing in the book this morning, looking at it, that you feel there is a progress toward a more human kind of humanity.
Right. Yes.
And I disagree with that formulation, as you know. I think that to treat human as though it were synonymous with humane, and that the more humane someone is, or that people are, the more human they are, I think that's misleading. I think that efforts toward being more humane, the way of decent, compassionate, cooperative, concerned, foresighted, and concerned, that occurs, and humans are capable of that. And sometimes in places, there's more of it than in others. But I think it goes up and down. When Martin Luther King says, the arc of the moral universe, very long, but it bends toward justice.
Yes.
I don't believe that. I don't think it bends one way or the other.
Well, you know, as you say, I write about this in my book. Aristotle said that it's the law of contradictions. It's a law in saying that a thing cannot be both a man and not a man. Well, I think that the way we use the word human is very interesting because we use it in two opposite meanings. And also, Burke introduced an interesting term. He used it conservatively, but it doesn't have to be. Our second nature. We're born with one kind of nature. We yell and scream. We want to be fed. We want that breast. And then we learn to moderate our own desires with those of other people. We reach a certain degree of ego. And we really, when we talk about human beings, we're not talking about squalling infants. We're talking about grown adults who have used their humanity differently. And then a few people go even beyond that, I think, and think not just about their own interests, but obviously there are people who worry about the future, and they are gaining in numbers and strength. When you say there's no progress,
there's progress in this or that effect, accompanied by retrogression, if you like, in humane values in other respects, and what is gained can be lost, and what is lost can be gained. There is not an overall on balance movement toward greater wisdom. I don't see it.
Well, I want to say that it's not exactly on the level of wisdom, but it does have to do with the question of humanity, that in Roman times it was a pleasure to go to the arena and watch Christians being thrown to the lions. I don't think anyone's going to revive that form of entertainment, no matter what happens in this country. We're not going back there because there has been a cultural evolution away from the pleasure of seeing other people being mangled to death by wild beasts. We're not going back there. There has been a very slow, painful evolution.
1965, you opened my eyes very significantly to the nature of our society and our policies and whatever with your work on the Indonesian massacre of 1965. The violence which we do in the world has become, for America, more overt and denied and less visible than for the Indians, let's say, or the period of slavery, but hardly less. The year of 65, which is when Lyndon Johnson got the Voting Act, I think, was 65, in that year, the United States entirely invisibly was encouraging and participating in the slaughter of between 500,000 and 2-3 million people in Indonesia, which to this day remains virtually unknown in this country, which has as much glasnost openness as any empire has ever had, except for Russia under Gorbachev in his last years, which was more open than we've ever seen, but since then. And we still don't know anything about that. and we managed to keep it invisible. It's meant that we weren't doing it. Now, who was it who regarded that as a great success to be boasted of? Well, McGeorge Bundy, as I said, the dean of faculty, former of Harvard. But McNamara, who regarded that as a great success and a great victory, had lived in Ann Arbor because he was very active in the NAACP as well as the ACLU. He was a very strong civil rights advocate. McNamara was very, very happy about the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Act. Was he, because he gloried in the massacre of 500,000 people, including many who were thought to be communists and many who weren't thought to be communists in Indonesia, was he less human than us, you or me or others? I think not.
I think we have to, as in the context here, to think the way they thought and why people could say the things that McGeorge Bundy said. Stalin killed something like 4 million people in the Ukraine. Well, incredibly stupid reason that he wanted to collectivize agriculture and couldn't happen it. You'd already had the Great Leap Forward in China, which killed maybe 30 million people.
Right. Even
so
worse.
What's 1 or 2 million people? We're stopping that from happening in Indonesia. That's the way they thought.
Now, wait. I was in the government then. Uh-huh. Let me tell you that McGeorge Bundy and McNamara did not believe that if Sukarno were supplanted by the Communist Party, that there would be massacres like the Ukraine or the Great Leap Forward. They really didn't believe that if the largest communist party, unarmed, a popular open party, as you informed me, the largest communist party in the world outside the bloc, if they came to power in an election, as they would, and if we let that happen, there would be slaughters in Indonesia like Pol Pot. No. They were concerned about Freeport sulfur.
They were, but not just that. And honestly,
I was their colleague and their subordinate.
All right.
Peter, don't tell me they were concerned about saving lives in Indonesia.
I was in the U.N. I talked to a lot of Americans. That was the decade where both America and the Soviet Union, they shared this belief that by the end of the century, one power would be running the whole world. And the issue was it going to be America or was it going to be Russia? And one of the reasons that the massacre occurred in Indonesia was because of that kind of long-term thinking. It wasn't 100% Freeport mining.
You are mistaken, Peter, when you say that. Let me tell you something that happened in 1965 with McNamara. It's very interesting. By the way, McNamara, I think, never spent 1 minute of his life worrying that by the end of the century, communism might be running the world. Not 1 minute did ever anybody imagine that, or did CIA ever suggest the possibility of that. But here's something that happened that's really little known, although it's in a book by Richard Goodwin. In 1965, when I went to Vietnam, actually, at the time of the massacre in Indonesia, I went there in early September. We were bombing, of course, Vietnam, as we had been under his pressure since February in the Rolling Thunder campaign. He pressed for a bombing halt in November, roughly, of 1965 and December. In compromise with the military, he said, we'll make it a temporary thing, and we will call for negotiations, give them a chance. Mm-hmm. And even put it, if they don't respond, we will bomb them more than before. That's what they wanted to do. But my strong belief, based on a lot of evidence, is that that was his compromise. He didn't want to restart the bombing, but he hoped that possibly if we had a pause in the bombing and appealed for negotiations, they might respond.
And the CIA subsidized a meeting in Switzerland where people got together. It was structured.
I think McNamara wanted to get out of the war at that point. He was telling Johnson about November that he saw at best a 50. He said there's at least a 50% chance that a year from now we will be at a much higher level of violence, as we were, of course, with more troops there, and no progress has been made, a stalemate. At least he could have said better 97%, but he said 50%. Anyway, he wanted to get out at that point. Okay, now here's the point. There's a bombing pause, and of course they're not responding because we in no way suggested that we would allow a coalition government with the MLF in it at that point. Nobody was hinting at that, although McNamara absolutely was in favor of that. I knew much later. So Richard Goodwin, the former speechwriter for Johnson, including early that year, had now left the government, partly over Vietnam. He tells in his memoir that he went to see McNamara in December to urge him to sustain the bombing hold, you know, keep it going. Not knowing, at the time he wrote the book, he still didn't know, obviously, what was now pretty well documented. That's what McNamara was calling for internally. He did extend it beyond Christmas, into January.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
He was extending it. And that was because he wanted to get out, but he didn't tell Goodwin that. So Goodwin is trying to persuade him to do what he was urging internally to do. And in the course of this, here's the way Goodwin tells the story. He said, I was telling this, and suddenly McNamara interrupted me, and he went over to the side of his wall, which I remember very well. It's a huge map of the world. Mm-hmm. And he says, Dick, what difference would it make if all of this area, and he pointed to Southeast Asia, Malaysia, remember, Indonesian coup had already happened. It so
right,
happened.
Yeah.
But all of this other area, including India, he definitely included India, mm-hmm. went communist. And Goodwin says, you can look this up, Goodwin says, well, I didn't come here to discuss that, Mr. McNamara. I just wanted to talk about the bombing halt. You know, and as he was saying that, McNamara interrupted him and said, it wouldn't make a goddamn bit of difference to the United States. That's right. What he said. Wouldn't make any difference to us. It all went communist. So Goodwin, who's internally, and he's telling this many years later in his memoir, hasn't changed his understanding of the situation, said, I was so appalled at this statement, meaning, why are we bombing when you don't think it would make any difference? The reality was McNamara was pressing not to bomb because he thought it would make no difference, but he didn't tell Goodwin that. But Goodwin said, I was so appalled at this statement that I couldn't say anything. I sort of mumbled and I left the office.
Yeah, but then you're using that as an anecdote to illustrate the thinking of everybody. But there were people who did think in terms of who's going to be controlling the world at the
name
end of
one.
The century.
Name one.
Well, I don't. I mean, I used to talk to them.
Think of a name. I remember it's hard in these days. I never met one. Tell me one person. We were in the Foreign Service. He was a career Foreign Service for a while. I wasn't. I was in FSR Reserve. We'd both been in the Foreign Service, in other words. Mm-hmm. And he was in Poland. But what I'm saying is, I never in my years working with the government met someone who thought there was the slightest chance in the world. They did think the Soviets may destroy us with their nuclear weapons, which at that time they didn't have. Mm-hmm. I was worried about that. I was spending sleepless nights about that. But that they would, by a combination of military and political means, be dominant in the world without having destroyed us?
I think if we go back to the 40s, the concern about the Iron Curtain, the Fulton, Missouri
but
speech
not the world.
Of Churchill.
Not that we will become communists, no. No.
I think that the concern, well, you know, it was Stalin's, you know, he was socialism in one country, but Khrushchev saying at the UN, I wish he hadn't, we will bury you. He wasn't saying that just as an idle bluff. I believe he believed that. He believed that communism was going to be the wave of the future.
He may have believed that, but who in the U.S.? Thought he was correct.
Well, the issue is whether people believed he was correct in 1961 or wherever he said it.
No, they did not. That's
okay.
The,
all right,
that's
but
the issue
I'm saying
answer.
In the 40s and the early 50s, I think they were very concerned about
that. I'm saying very strongly,
that.
Peter, that it's a matter not just of American empire, but of humanity. What I'm saying is that in our empire in 1965, no one thought that the massacre in Indonesia was saving Indonesian lives. That was of zero, zero concern.
Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this week's program, we are listening to part of a conversation between Daniel Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott, recorded in October of 2018. In the final segment of this week's show, concluding thoughts by Scott and Ellsberg, with Aaron Good, who arranged the interview.
actually about over time at this point. And if we're
well, I hate to end on such a...
So would you like to have a
vituperative ending here? I'm just taking issue with that point.
Okay.
Because I'm saying, look, if Americans are like that, we're not the worst in the world and we're not that different. Are other people like that? You point to racism elsewhere. I've never made the point that we're the worst in anything except in our initiation of the doomsday machine. But aside from that, not the worst in anything. But to say that somebody else is even worse than we are, it doesn't give me any reassurance at all.
Well, I certainly don't want to have that left as my position. My position is a slightly different one, and that is that precisely because the problems in America are so overt and so serious and so grave, that this country has become skilled in the efforts of dealing with what seem to be intractable problems like racism. And let us not forget that the civil rights movement of the 1960s is one of the huge success stories of the 20th century. And the other one, which matches it in a way, is the Solidarity Movement in Poland, which I'm writing about right now in my book on Czesław Miłosz. And again, this seems something totally impossible, that ordinary human beings forced the largest land army in the world to withdraw from a country and lead to the coming down of the Berlin Wall. This sort of thing seemed nothing short of miraculous, but it happened.
Remind me what year that you're
the, well, Solidarity, in a sense, flourished from through 1979, 80, 81, and on paper was crushed by the imposition of martial law by Jaruzelski. So it looked like they had been defeated.
What year did you do that?
81, the end of 81. But that so nakedly exposed the government in Warsaw as a puppet of... I mean, his reason for doing it, his overt reason, he said, I did this so that the Soviet army wouldn't do it. That was the end of the credibility of the Warsaw government. Before that, not being it when I was there, it was a credible government. It had lost its credibility long before 1980, but it was absolutely finished then, and in the end, the Solidarity Movement took over and became the government.
Let me explain that, by the way, and apologize. My vituperation here at my beloved friend, my best friend.
I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It didn't upset me the slightest bit when you told me I was categorically wrong.
Let me tell you something, though, that I realized last night. You're talking about 81, and if you wouldn't. Solidarity appeared to be crushed. Mm-hmm. That's pre-Gorbachev.
Yes.
And then Gorbachev comes in, and the wall eventually comes down by the end of that decade. Mm-hmm. Absolutely unforeseeable. Fine. So, and that something like that must happen in the world, I would say.
Yes.
Is it possible? Yes, it happened. It is possible. Is it likely? Well, let's ask this one point. It struck me that with the ending of the intermediate range missile test, the INF, Intermediate Range Missile Forces Treaty, which Trump announced that he was going to withdraw from.
Yeah, but it's about like the Iran thing. America will pull out. It's not the end of the treaty. There are other countries will stay in.
Actually, the treaty is only bilateral.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought the Europeans...
No, not at all.
Oh, okay, I'm wrong.
Trump has now said we're not going to care what they say about it one way or the other. I mean, they have no say in the treaty. Mm-hmm. Now, we can't put missiles over there without their agreement, intermediate range missiles, and they're not happy to do it. What I'm saying is, as Gorbachev has pointed out, he says, yes, things can go on. He signed that treaty in 1983. So what is that? I don't know. What year was it? 1987.
So that's 31 years.
He signed that treaty. So here they're canceling it, in effect. Mm-hmm. It struck me that what is happening right now is that we're back in terms of a Cold War demonization of Russia, not by Trump, but by both elite parties, both the elites in both parties, a Cold War, a tremendous buildup on both sides, as in 1981, 93, 83, under Reagan and under Brezhnev.
And a propagandizing media, the Times, they're just full of anti-Putin.
That's right. We are, to a very considerable extent, back where we were in 83. And by the way, as we speak, the largest NATO exercises since 1983 are underway in NATO, and the largest Soviet, I should say Russian exercises, much larger actually. Ours are about 50,000, theirs are 300,000, including 3,000 Chinese, since the Second World War. The largest exercises are going on. Meanwhile, the largest number in many years of close encounters between warships and planes in the Baltics and elsewhere,
and the South China Sea too,
are going on. Possibility of their planes are sometimes flying within 5 feet of our jets, or a ship of theirs 125 feet from one of our ships. Possibility of collisions, of clashes of various kinds.
There was a collision in the,
what?
Didn't we have a collision with the Chinese?
Oh, collisions occur every now and then, but there will be collisions. We're back to 83 as if the Cold War hadn't ended. So that something like 35 years of progress, as you say, genuine opportunity and progress, are being wiped out, and we're in a very
challenged.
Similar...
Not wiped out, challenged.
So,
okay.
That's our challenge.
It is our challenge, and I want to thank you, Daniel Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott, for taking this time. I think this is a sprawling, really illuminating conversation about a lot of the most important historical events of the last century, and it's been really wonderful to sit down with you today. I'm glad you both agreed to do this, and I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. And thank as you. I've said before, there is no one on earth that I've learned more from about how the world works and about humanity than my friend Peter Dale Scott.
I was the student here, and this is the man who saw it firsthand and wrote this brilliant, two brilliant books about what he saw that everyone should read.
We've just heard excerpts from a conversation between Daniel Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott, The Deep State and the Doomsday Machine. Thanks to all of those who made this recording possible, especially John Bertucci, Dennis Murphy, and Anthony Fest. Special thanks to Aaron Good, as well as the guests, Peter Dale Scott and Daniel Ellsberg. This, again, was part of a conversation recorded at the Media Freedom Summit 2.0, sponsored by Project Censored, in October of 2018 at the College of Marin.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Special thanks for this week's program and future programs featuring Dan Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott to John Bertucci of KPCA in Petaluma, California. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. Please follow and like us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Also, please follow our work at projectcensored.org, where you can find archives of all of our programs going back to 2010, as well as all of our top censored stories going back to 1976. Thanks again for listening. Please tune in next week. Genocide wars, far for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers in our